Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. I am so excited. I have my favorite author in the whole world on this morning, and I have to tell you, the sun is shining. Yay, thank you very much. And there's no more rain. But before I start, I promise that, you know, this is a teenager alert. My nephew, Jake Wallace, is turning 13 tomorrow, and I promised him, as a tradition of everyone in the family, to make sure that the whole world knew that he was turning 13 tomorrow. He's one of the nicest kids. He's one of the nicest kids on this planet. He called me last night to thank me for my present, and I told him, you're definitely my nephew because he likes shopping for clothes like I do, so he's cool. So happy birthday, Jake, and happy 13. Watch out, everybody. He's a teenager. But I have my favorite person in the whole world on here, and he's the author of the Caitlin Strong series. Strong Cold Dead is John Land at his best. Isis comes to Texas in this next installment of the critically acclaimed and award-winning author of From Just Reviews, 2016 Top Book of the Year, Best Book of the Year, Strong Cold Dead. Good morning, John. How are you?
Can I just be quiet and keep listening, because this is fun? I mean, I almost think, well, I think Jake and I are just gonna like start emailing back and forth while you keep talking about us, because but it's funny. I knew I was coming on today, and you know, this is my favorite show to do, and I'm working on the next Caitlin Strong book, and I was thinking of this last night yesterday I had a 25 page day, a plus 5,000 word day. And, you know, here's the thing, and this is not a question. You're not asking me a question. I'm just going to come out and say it. I enjoy writing these Caitlin Strong books so much. I'm writing Strong to the Bone right now. I'm halfway through. I can't stop. I think as a writer, that's the key to hooking a reader. You have to hook yourself first. You can't know everything that's going to happen and what you're doing, because the more you surprise yourself, the more your characters surprise you, the more fun the reader is going to have. And what I realized yesterday as I was thinking about this interview and working was, if the reader has as much fun reading a Caitlin Strong book as I did writing the same book, then they're in for a blast. I mean, they're going to have such a blast with Strong Cold Dead. They're just not going to believe it.
Well, Strong Cold Dead was fantastic. And do I have fun reading them? Not only do I have fun reading them, everyone, I learn a lot. Because John does a lot of historical history, and he says it takes us back in time, and you know me, I look up everything. And so I learn an awful lot about different people that I might have forgotten about or want to learn about. So Caitlin Strong, you don't want to mess with her. She's a strong ranger. You don't want to get her on her bad side, because she won't wind up on any side. So tell us seriously. And she, you know,
on the wrong
side
of the ground is where you're going to end up.
Yes, exactly right. And every time I read one of your books, I remind myself that I've got a kind of strong personality too, which is really great. And, I adapt some of her little ideas, because, you know, you got to be tough in this world. So you created Caitlin Strong, and you're going to tell us how you created her, and why did you decide to take us back to the southern plantations and focus on the Comanche Indians? That was interesting.
Well, let me answer the second question first, and then we'll get to the first one
if I
remember. Because, I'm a senior moment. One of my favorite things in these books, and I think what sets them apart from other thrillers, because there are so many thrillers out there, is in every Caitlin Strong title, in every straight Caitlin Strong book, there's a flashback thread to one of her. She's a fifth generation Texas Ranger. So there's a flashback thread, a historical thread in the story, a historical plot line that features one of her ancestors, her father, grandfather, great-grandfather, or great-great-grandfather, investigating something in their day that is directly relevant to what Caitlin is investigating in her day. You reference the fictional Comanche Indian reservation. Well, mm-hmm. I think it's 1873, 1874, her great-great-grandfather, Steel Dust Jack Strong. How about that for a nickname? Steel Dust Jack. That's what they call him. Is investigating a bizarre murder just outside the grounds of an Indian reservation. In the present, a comparable murder occurs 150 years later. that is connected to something mysterious on that land. In the past thread, John D. Rockefeller is after oil. In the present thread that Caitlin's investigating, an oil and energy tycoon is after something else that's actually the real mystery on what's going on in that land. And what thrillers are, Fran, are puzzles. In the difference between a mystery and a thriller, to give you an example of what I'm talking about, a mystery is trying to figure out who did what to who and why. A thriller is about trying to prevent something terrible from happening. But before you can prevent it, you have to figure it out. And that's where the puzzle comes in. And that's what makes these books so much fun. Now, the second part of the question about where Caitlin Strong came from. Well, I believe that often the best, necessity is a mother of invention. Well, I needed to write a new series. Basically, Caitlin came about because the head of the mass market sales department of my publisher said thrillers are our most popular genre, and most books are bought by women. Why is there not a female thriller action hero? Why is there no female Jack Reacher? Why is there no female Mitch Rapp? Why is there no female who can go toe-to-toe with the strongest man and do everything or almost everything that a traditional male hero can do? The problem with our genre, if there's such a thing, is that an inordinate number of the heroes are burnt out ex-special operators. That's been the case ever since the wake of the Vietnam War, when every thriller hero you encountered was a Vietnam War veteran. Now they all seem to be Navy SEALs. They all seem to be Delta Force. They're all Green Berets or something like it, who have a terrible secret and something they've done in their past they need to redeem themselves for. Well, Caitlin has none of that. And that makes her so fresh and vital and original. I'm not putting down, by the way, authors who are using that kind of hero. I'm not putting them down at all. I read those books. But there is a repetition. There is a kind of recycling sense that as soon as, like as a book reviewer, when I open a jacket deciding whether I want to read the book by someone I've never heard of, if I see ex-Navy SEAL in the first paragraph, I really don't want to read that book. It feels like I've read it before. Mm. And that's what Caitlin Strong represents to me, a kind of 180-degree twist in the traditional thriller hero.
Well, you're right, because she is unique and different, and I've read how many thrillers and mystery thrillers?
I'd say 500, 5,000, 20. I mean, who knows? Fran, it's I don't even want to think about it. It makes me feel too old.
You're not too old.
Because I wrote a lot of
them. Time. I know. And I'll tell you, I read a scary one this morning. Actually, I read a whole one this morning. James Patterson's Never Never. That's really scary. And the way he ended it, I go, oh, my God, he's going to write a sequel to this one. It's not out yet. It's coming out in January. But for those of you that get frightened easily, you can read that one, too. You've mentioned that they want to do some drilling on the land, the Comanches, and they want to protect their land. And I just read a book called Yellow Hair by Andrew Joyce, and it deals with the Sioux Indians. And if you listen to the news, the Dakota Indians, they're still doing that. They still want to go after their land, and they still want to hurt them.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's sad. It's not right. So in the present, how does Caitlin become involved in this story? And what weapon has been created that's so deadly that someone from Homeland Security's radar is up there? As she saw him at a protest, it took her time to realize that it was ISIS.
And this book is ISIS Comes to Texas, but what gets Caitlin involved directly.
Yeah.
And here's the important thing about these books. Here's another reason why I love writing these books. And why I have such an affection for these characters. Caitlin doesn't get involved because she's assigned to go to the reservation as a Texas Ranger.
Mm.
She gets involved because there's a protest very similar to what you see going on today. I think it's in North Dakota with the protest about the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar to that, there's a line of protesters, one of whom is her surrogate son, college student from Brown University, Dylan Torres, who is the son of her outlaw boyfriend, Court Wesley Masters. So Dylan has fallen in love or has a crush on or is dating, however you choose to put it, an Indian girl who's come back and she's been teaching school. She's been taking time off from college to do all this stuff. And she kind of baits him. She kind of tempts him. She's like the femme fatale. She clearly is using him for something else, and Caitlin knows it, but doesn't know what. Here's my point. Caitlin does not go there because it's her job. She goes there because someone she loves is getting themselves in trouble. What I try to do, and this is the point I want to get at, what I try to do in the Caitlin Strong books and what differentiates them, or let me put it this way, that I hope I want to be as good as James Lee Burke. I want to be as good as David Morrell. I want to be as good as Steve Barry. I want to challenge my characters, not just physically. I want to challenge them emotionally. So what I try to do is marry the structural core of the story with the emotional core of the story. Because no book is fun to read if you don't have a vested interest and an emotional attachment to the characters. I want you as the reader to feel the same way about Caitlin as I do, so that when you're reading Strong Cold Dead, it's not just a formulaic action mashup, but it's about people who are making mistakes and trying to recover from their mistakes and realizing that sometimes somebody knows more than they do. And the fun I have with this series is not just writing Caitlin, but it's writing everybody, because everyone in the series, even the characters you're only going to meet in Strong Cold Dead, because spoiler alert, no villain ever comes back in any of my books. So you kind of know where the book is going, including ISIS. And there's an interesting point. You raised ISIS in this. Why did I do that? If you know everyone, I did it because, in fact, I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated by the terrible things that happen and the nightclub shooting in Orlando and, you know, the shooting in outside Sacramento. I think it was outside Sacramento or the tech area where it's frustrating because we don't win. The thing about reading thrillers is they're cathartic in the sense that when you read a thriller, again, little spoiler alert, the good guys win in the end. Because we don't need to read to see what we can see on the news every night. We read books and we watch movies and TV shows a lot of times to realize that there are still heroes. There are still people who can make us winners. This is why, and I don't want to talk politics, but why did Donald Trump become president? Because basically, well, there's a lot of reasons, but let's be simple. Let's be simplistic. Make America great again. In other words, rediscover your heroes. We can win. And I think this is a message that everyone can attach themselves onto. And the message of the Caitlin Strong series is good guys win more than anything else. Now, it's not easy, and there's a cost associated inevitably with that victory. But the good guys prevail.
Unfortunately, I really wish that in real life the good guys would prevail. ISIS just did something in Berlin and in Germany, and they somebody went into a market and killed all those people.
Now,
and
you see, you're
they
absolutely
get, they
right.
They get blindsided all the time. They get blindsided all the time there, and that's scary.
Now, here's the cathartic element of that. If I write that kind of scene, and believe me, and you know what? It's probably a scene I should write, and you just gave me the opening scene of the next Caitlin Strong book, Fran. I want to thank you for that.
You're welcome. Just give me credit somewhere.
But the thing is, when I see something like a truck in Nice or a truck in Berlin, it's just horrifying when you think that these people were out shopping, they were out celebrating, they were with their families, they were with their friends, and they didn't ask for any of this. And so, but if Caitlin Strong had been there, she would have stepped out in front of the truck, pulled her, you know, her Sig Sauer 9mm, and shot the guy through the windshield and hit him all 12 times, 14 times. Boom, boom, boom. The truck veers off. It'll slam into a building and nobody gets killed. That's the difference between a thriller and real life. It's the catharsis. It's so important to define to that your heroes, that our heroes in fiction, whether that be film, television, or anything in pop culture, that our heroes can do what ordinary people and ordinary heroes cannot do. And a lot of it is timing. A hero is normally a hero because of where they are at a certain time. Let's take, for example, a terrorist attack that didn't happen. In France, on a train 3 years ago, a gunman was starting up an aisle, and there happened to be two U.S. Marines in a seat. Nobody got killed. The only people who got wounded were the Marines. One of them got nicked with a knife, and the other had a sore shoulder. But they stopped. They saved dozens of lives on that train. Not because they got on the train to do it, but because they happened to be there. And that is what happens a great deal of the time in thrillers. Coincidence becomes the driving force. A hero just happening to be somewhere when he's needed, or she's needed in this case. So as they say, Fran, timing is everything.
Now I'm going to ask the next question because we're going to bring in someone else. You mentioned Court Wesley's son, Dylan, and you mentioned Ella. And did I realize that she was up to no good? Yeah, of course I figured that one out.
Of course you did.
Whoa. Of course I did. But you know what? Guys get blindsided, people. She's pretty. She convinced him to do things he would never normally do because he's not that kind of person. So he was blindsided by her. But her grandfather is White Eagle, and he doesn't like him either. And Dylan's such a sweet kid. So White Eagle is a descendant of White Eagle that Steel Dust Strong introduces us in the past. So how does this come together in the present? And why doesn't her grandfather trust Dylan? What's his problem?
That's a very good question. And I think that, well, first off, there is a very insular nature to the Native people on these Indian reservations. I did a fictional book that you and I have talked about called Takedown, about an investigation investigation that involved the St. Regis Mohawk Reservation on the Canadian-American border. And what you learn in the course of researching that book, my co-author, Lindsay Preston, who's a very noted ghostwriter, was basically told when she was researching with the police, the undercover drug officer that the book is about, they were basically told you can't be on this land at night. It's not safe. Remember, it's not America as we know it. It is sovereign land that belongs to the Indians, in the case of my book, the Comanche. It's all they have. It's all the government gave them. So they feel betrayed. They feel like they got the short end of the stick, justifiably so, as you mentioned before. So they're very insular. Yeah. They're very isolated. They're very alienated. They just want to keep to themselves. At many Indian reservations, if not most, if a Caucasian or a black or some or a Hispanic marries a Native girl, they cannot live on the reservation. They're not allowed. Only Natives are allowed. That's not true of all of them, but that's the nature of people like the ones I portray in Strong Cold Dead. Is they're very suspicious of outsiders because of what outsiders have done to them ever since, the Pilgrims and all the stories from those days. We don't have a good history with the people who are the only nativists in this country. So when people harangue about immigrants, if you're not a Native American, you are an immigrant, period. You could be sixth generation, fifth generation, fourth generation, first generation. You are not pure. You're the only people who are purebred Americans are Native Americans. So, and I think they take that seriously. I think they take that to heart.
Yeah, I can imagine they do. And that isn't right either. So when my computer is deciding, the bat light went out. Why and how did the Indians, this was interesting because this is all true. that they got conned into with a whole bunch of money, whatever, and they got sort of conned and threatened and coerced to losing the rights to their land. And how and why did they do that? And White Eagle is not stupid. He knew what they were doing. And yet, for some reason, the Indians lost just about everything that was really theirs, and that isn't right, too. So how did they get that, and what happens when Dylan listens to White Eagle and hears his stories about the past and gets Peyton involved in the present?
Well, Dylan is 21 years old. He's an idealist. You know, he is listening to – he's kind of falling for the entire thing, because here's the one thing you left out, and this is crucial. Mm-hmm. When it comes to Native Americans and reservations, the U.S. government sold them out in the 19th century, in the 1800s. Yeah. They were sold out by our own government. They were settled on reservations, which is basically the worst locations, the worst land. I mean, it has the value of land not that far away from where they are. They really got the blank end of the stick. The problem with what you see today, because of oil on the Bakken Range and the whole thing with the pipeline in North Dakota, is Native Americans have been sold out by their own people. The tribal elders, and this, someday is going to write an amazing Shakespearean book about North Dakota and all the infighting. The chief of that tribe is now in jail for murder, or accused of murder. The North Dakota, I think it was the Blackfoot in that case. Because of all the corruption, all the payoffs, all the greed, all the parcels of land that were sold, the mineral rights, because that's part of – you're asking me a question about how it happens. Here's how it happens. When someone tricks someone into selling their land, they don't tell them that they're selling the land. They're only leasing the mineral rights to the land. That's how this is sold to the people who live on the reservation, who don't understand. They're being offered a lot of money for mineral rights. But nobody reads the fine print, because what you're giving the broker the right to do is resell those mineral rights to an oil company, who then takes possession of the land in order to drill. So the mineral rights companies and the oil companies, you can't bag up enough cash to pay off people who make the decision of who gets the contracts. So you tell me, what's worse, being sold out by your own national government, or being sold out by your own tribal leaders? It's both have happened to Native Americans, and you don't have to look very far or try very hard to see the upshot of that in their lifestyle and their culture.
That's scary. Because you don't, at this point, they didn't know who to trust, and trust no one.
No,
yourself.
And that's the thing about that. When people say thrillers are fluff, they're entertainment, they don't really mean anything,
they're not
about anything, so wrong. Because great thrillers endure. Great thriller writers endure because they're ahead of the curve. When 9/11 happened, Fran, this is a true story, because I know two of the authors who were involved in this. One is Brad Meltzer. One was the late, great Vince Flynn. Another is, I think, Christopher Reich, but I'm not 100% sure. When 9/11 happened, the government called together these thriller writers. Now, they can't, by the way, talk about what they discussed, because it's classified. I don't know even what Brad Meltzer talked about in that room. But they were asked to conceive the next attack on the United States, because the government and the military wanted to know it from the minds of people who make a living anticipating what's coming next. This is not unusual, but 9/11 was foretold by Thomas S. Harris's book, Black Sunday, written in 1972, 40 years before, when Thomas Harris, who went on to create Hannibal Lecter, where in Black Sunday he envisions a terrorist attack at the Super Bowl.
I remember that I read that.
And, you know, a phenomenal thriller. Ira Levin, before anyone knew what cloning was, wrote The Boys from Brazil about cloning Hitler. You learned about cloning when you read that Ira Levin's book. That's how you discovered cloning. The same thing is true of terrorism and how, in this case, Palestinian terrorist Black September functioned. If you want to see how Black September functions, you read Black Sunday. My point is, thriller writers don't just hold up a mirror to the way we are. They shine the mirror ahead into how we're going to be and the threats we're going to face. And that's why people love reading thrillers. It's like a glimpse into tomorrow. And that's where the fun lies.
It is. And every time I read one of your books, I get eye strain, people, because I sit down and read it and I don't stop until I finish it. And then I read it again to make sure that when I do the review of my questions, I get it right. So you have to read the Caitlin Strong series, and you really should read them from the beginning, only because they make great Hanukkah Christmas presents, and you can just get them all as a box set. That's just my hint for the day.
And they're available in digital and audio. They're available in every conceivable way.
That's exactly right. So what happens when Dylan listens to White Eagle and hears his stories from the past? And what I love about Caitlin, because someone said that to me the other day that read one of your books, namely my sister-in-law, that won't give it back. She's got all the rest of them that you sent me, and she's waiting for The Rising, but she's not getting that one so fast either. Caitlin operates on her own terms and own wavelength, and that adds to her power and strength, and, you know, it's a good way to be, people. And she's careful, but she's impetuous, and she breaks the rules, and she very rarely trusts anyone except one of my favorite characters, of course, Wesley and Paz and her sons. How come? And when she goes at it with Captain Topper, I crack up laughing because he's going to lose no matter what. He's going to lose. I mean, he may be a strong, typical character, and he knows he's going to lose with her because she's going to do it her way anyway, so just let her do it, right? So how come she is that way? I love her. That's why I love her, because I'm becoming just like her, which is great.
She's like that because that is the classic frontier hero tradition. The American hero, the thriller hero that we have today, owes its roots to characters in the past like Natty Bumppo from the great Last of the Mohicans series, Huckleberry Finn, the characters who were outside the norm, characters who weren't afraid to take chances and risks. When Huck frees Jim and they go up the Mississippi River in the raft chapters in Huckleberry Finn, when Natty Bumppo is out there trying to save the white people that he has renounced in becoming the surrogate son of Chingachgook. You know, so Caitlin is irreverent. She marches to the beat of her own drummer because of her convictions and because she's not afraid to go it alone. This is the American hero tradition. A loner, Ethan Edwards, the John Wayne character in The Searchers, Shane in Alan Ladd, the Yul Brynner character in The Magnificent Seven, what do they have in common? They never end up staying. They never end up going home. And what you're illuminating and what you're basically getting to here is the push and pull of Caitlin's character. Her nature as a Texas Ranger, as a modern-day gunfighter, which is essentially what she is what defines her. But that is constantly at odds with her maternal instincts and her relationship with Court Wesley's two sons that she has become the surrogate mother of. In other words, this series emotionally is a constant struggle to have it both ways. To have your cake and eat it too. For Caitlin to do in this series of books what very few heroes in American pop culture and history have ever been able to do, which is have a family, have roots, have a home, but also be able to ride off and kill the bad guys. You know, and that's what she is essentially. So I've turned the paradigm around. In the way this is normally done, the woman is trying to get the man to settle down, to hang up his guns. In this case, Court Wesley Masters is the single father raising two boys in their teens. Now, Dylan, I mentioned in his early 20s, And it's the woman who's the one who can't settle down. So it's a change in the paradigm. And it's a switch in the traditional way storytelling is done. But it adheres, the Caitlin Strong books adhere, to the general tenets, the general rules of what makes an American hero.
That's true, because Caitlin Strong, she's called the Lone Wolf Texas Ranger, which I really love, the Lone Ranger. Lone Wolf Texas Ranger is really great. But yeah, you got to tell everybody about that first scene, because I could still smell the stink bomb. And the first scene.
Well,
that
I have
first
a little
scene, you got that's an opening. I mean, that was priceless, let me tell you. The way
you know
did
something?
That, oh, my God.
I have a tradition where, and now sometimes you box yourself in as a writer because, you know, I like opening every book with a scene where I show Caitlin in action. Not necessarily
yeah,
a gunfight,
hilarious.
Because that's easy. So in this case, of course, I did this in large part because the motto of the Texas Rangers, because remember, a lot of what Caitlin does in these books is very true to the way the Rangers are, were, and always have been. This is the way they operate. I didn't invent this. I just exploited it more or less. But I like to introduce her doing something that shows her as the kind of person that she is, that shows her in action. So in the beginning of Strong Cold Dead, I mentioned the motto of the Texas Rangers is one riot, one ranger. And there's a riot that's been going on every night for 3 nights. There was a police shooting. In other words, I'm pulling on to current events in San Antonio, and there's a neighborhood that's erupting in violence and looting and flames, and it really looks like it's going to get out of control, and it's just going to go up the streets toward the Alamo, toward the Riverwalk, you know, places where violence doesn't usually reach. Well, Caitlin doesn't want to see a lot of people get mowed down by rubber bullets and tear gas and machine guns eventually. So when they won't let her, no one will listen to her. She says she's got a way. Well, of course, she's going to do it anyway. That's the point you're making. And what she does is, and this isn't giving it anything away, really, it's because the scene doesn't become vital for the rest of the book, although it does establish a theme. She dumps this concoction of what is basically skunk oil all over the rioters. And I'll tell you something. It's one thing to have your eyes burning. It's another thing to be shot at. But when you are in when you're like, just picture what it's like. Imagine being trapped in a closed room with a skunk. You're gonna run. You want to get out of there more than anything in the world. So she disperses the riot. She ends the riot by having a crop duster fly overhead, spraying this skunk oil on the rioters. Now, of course, she gets in trouble for this. In fact, I love this moment. Tell me if you love this moment when it looks like Homeland Security is going to charge her with unleashing a weapon of mass destruction. In this case, a stench. But one of the things that comes out in this book is the use a little bit. This is a little bit of a subplot here, and it goes to the reality-based, you know, technology that I use, that most thrill writers use. And that is, I did not invent the notion of using aroma as a weapon. This is something that has been studied. This is something that's being studied. And it's actually we're conducting experiments, from what I learned, a lot through the Israelis, for urban warfare, for enclosed fighting, for terrorist incursions, using aroma as a weapon. So we're already using sound. We're already using sonic waves. The cruise ships now defend themselves. Originally, it was water cannons. When pirates approach some of these big cruise ships or freighters, they now send out these sound pulses from this sound cannon, they call it, which literally makes it impossible to, you know, you can't keep going. You have to turn around because your eardrums are about to shatter. So the fun of writing these thrillers, Fran, again, is you're going to have a great time. And not only are you going to have a great time reading these Caitlin Strong books, reading a book like Strong Cold Dead, you're going to say a dozen times as you're reading it, is this real? Is that true? And I'm going to guarantee you something. If you ask yourself that question, the answer is yes. Now, how true is it? I believe strongly in the principle of Robert Louis Stevenson, who wrote Treasure Island, of course, Kidnapped, you know, one of the great adventure writers from a much earlier age, the 19th century, who said, "It doesn't matter to me if you believe what I'm writing is true. All that matters to me is you do not disbelieve it." That's the suspension of disbelief. Mm-hmm. I'm not giving you, a la Tom Clancy, 17 pages about how an aroma bomb works. I'm giving you enough so that you, I'm giving you what you need to know so you can understand what's happening and enjoy it. I'm an entertainer. My job is to keep you turning the pages when you're reading the same way I'm turning the pages metaphorically when I'm writing. So I don't want to burden you with technology, but at the same time, I want to use technology as a tool, and I want to use it as a, I want to use the tool properly. How many times have I read thrillers where a character screws a silencer on a revolver? You can't silence a revolver. Robert Ludlum, the most, one of the two or three most influential writers in my career, once had in a book, in an early book, a scene set in the Duesenberg assembly plant in Duesenberg, Germany. Except every Indian, every Duesenberg ever assembled was assembled in Indianapolis, Indiana. Clive Cussler has a scene in a book called Cyclops where a character fires a Stinger missile on the moon and blows something up. A Stinger missile is an air-propelled heat-seeking missile. It wouldn't work on the moon. So this is what I mean. You cannot have mistakes like that. But you also don't need to go to graduate school in order to write thrillers that rely on technology.
That is true. Well, there's a more, there's so many more questions I have to ask. I don't think I'm going to get through all of them. But we've got Jack Strong from the past and his connection to ISIS in the present. How did you connect that? And also, when they start to drill on the reservation, what is the toxin that they find and they don't want anybody to know about? And yeah, I did look it up so that I would get it right. Trust me.
Yeah, yeah, there's a secret. And the thing is that Rockefeller, and this is fictional because this is where this is where fiction and fact divert. Rockefeller is everything I say I portray him as in this book. The only thing that's not true is he never came to Texas at the time that I said he did. He did. Standard Oil was in Texas, obviously. But so that's fictionalized. I love using fictional real characters as MacGuffins, as villains. Rockefeller is after the oil on this Indian reservation. And there is oil on this on the same Indian reservation. But the reason the Comanche are not protecting the oil. They're protecting the same secret, the same something else is under that ground that explains a lot about their culture and their heritage and why nobody ever gets cancer and why the life expectancy is so vast on this Indian reservation. There's a secret. There's a secret there. But here's the thing. It's a secret that can be weaponized and turned into something exceptionally deadly. So when ISIS learns of his existence, they head to Texas to take it. At the same time, to take control of it. At the same time, these mineral rights people and this energy baron is after it strictly for the money. They want to exploit it for the money because it can be a good thing. And it's a double-edged sword. So the idea is what links, to answer your question, what links the Steel Dust Jack Strong, John D. Rockefeller subplot from the past with the Caitlin Strong plot in the present is the mystery on this Indian reservation that they will protect at all costs. And the great thing was, I know you have a lot of writers who listen to the show, so this will give you an idea of how I work and how – you know, I committed myself to doing exactly what I'm saying, but I had no idea what it was that was on the reservation. No idea at all. I was halfway through the book. I still had no idea because I didn't have to. You don't have to make the connections until later in the book. So mm-hmm. I was just cruising along. It was my editor, who's also my agent, the brilliant Natalia Aponte, who said, I've got an idea. Have you ever heard of dot, dot, dot? And she told me about an Indian, something that's a traditional delicacy to Native American tribes and also tribes in Mexico, which I had no idea existed. When you're a writer, this is one of the great things about being a writer, but it's also one of the challenges. You have to always listen, because I can't tell you how many times someone said something to me specifically about my work, specifically about a book, or something in general that I didn't, that stuck in my head, that I went, oh my God, because to have a great book, you need a light bulb to go off to get you started. And then you need a lot of other light bulbs to go off in the course of the writing. When I say the light bulb, that means things you didn't know before. If you know everything when you start a book, you're going to write a book where the reader is going to figure out everything that you knew, because readers are so damn smart. They've read so many of these books, and they've seen so many of these movies. You know, it's like try to fool them. You know, it's like talk to people about why does everybody, thriller fans, love the movie The Usual Suspects? Because none of us got the twist ending. None of us got the identity of Kaiser Sose. I don't know anybody who figured it out. Right, these readers are so smart. You've got to give them something they haven't seen before, something you haven't seen before. And when I tell writers that I write by the seat of my pants, that I write without outlining, what I say is this. If I don't know what's going to happen next, the reader can't know what's going to happen next. So if you're spontaneous, if you surprise yourself, you'll surprise the reader. And that's my modus operandi.
Well, I know, but before I forget, because I don't want to forget, it's in front of me. I'm not doing the show next week. I'm taking the week off to write my next Faces book. And you never know who I'm going to kill off behind the gravestone of my books. And yesterday somebody gave me some really great ideas, so that's the only thing.
See?
Jen, yeah, my doctor's nurse, she asked me if I would put this character in the book, and she told me why, and I said, Sarah, you're the best. From ND Urgent Care in Tarrytown. They take such great care of me. I brought them cookies and stuff yesterday, and for that they gave me a visit for nothing. They love me. January 3rd, I have the honor of interviewing another top author for the best nonfiction book for 2016, An Unexpected Prisoner, with Robert Weidman. He's a Vietnam POW. And it should be interesting to talk to him. On January 10th, the author of The Neely Girl. On January 16th, I have Alan Topol, Alan Jacobson. Joining the panel for the first time, Larry Farmer and David McCallop. We're going to talk about narrative voice. On January 19th, I have somebody by the name of John Land and Heather Graham. I was so psyched about this. We're going to talk about your new book, The Rising, which you won't figure out the ending to that one either. You won't even figure it out, period. And on January 26th, I read a book that was interesting, Child's Play. It should be interesting. And I'm excited to start February with one of my other favorite authors, Nightbird, Brian Freeman. That's a scary book, too. If you think that R.L. Stine is scary, this one is just as scary. And R.L. Stine just sent me, give me a kill, and whoa, that is really scary. So for those of you girls out there that want to become cheerleaders, I would think twice before and after I read the book. So what does White Eagles mean? And this is a very good saying, he says. When they threaten him or they want him to do something, he says, the land will take care of it. What does that mean? He says, the land will take care of itself. What does that mean?
It means the Native American people believe, and I think there's a lot of merit to this. In fact, I believe it too, that the land has a spirit, that nature is a force and has a. I wouldn't say they ascribe consciousness to nature, but they look at nature as an organic being, and they the Native American people have always, their legacy is a wonderful respect for the environment, they know that the land is a finite resource, And that if you treat the land well, it's where our water comes from. It's where our food comes from. We can't live without the land. So the Native Americans are obsessive that the land will protect them. Now, in the case of that you know, in generations past, there are many legends of the land doing just that, of spirits and Manitou coming out of the, you know, being summoned to guard or ward off those who would hurt the land. Now, in this book, the legend is being usurped a little bit. It's being used as subterfuge for something else. But it's rooted in this respect for the environment. And you know something? How much could we learn from our Native American forebears when you think of what we're doing to this planet? And I can't, you know, a lot of things frustrate me in the world. A lot of things anger me in the world. But climate change deniers, global warming deniers, you know, and some of these people are smart. These people have great educations. You know, it's not theoretical anymore. It's proven, it's accepted science that the globe is warming, the ice caps are melting. How much do you need? No, we can just push as much crap into the atmosphere, into the air, burn more ozone away. Let's just raise the temperature of the oceans by 2 degrees in the next 20 years, which would basically flood every major city in the United States on the coastline. Of course, some of these people would probably prefer that because their people are not on those coastlines. You know, if you eliminate the coast, well, I'm getting political again. I don't want to do that. But the bottom line is, if you don't respect the environment, the environment's not going to respect you. And there's going to be a day where you're not going to be able to breathe the air. You know, there's a great moment in the book, The 6 Days of the Condor, in the movie, The 3 Days of the Condor, when Cliff Robertson says to Robert Redford, what happens when they turn on the faucets and the water doesn't come out? What happens when they go to the gas station and all the pumps are empty? They won't ask us how. They'll just say, get it for me. And what they're basically saying, and that movie is about resources. It's about oil and what we will do. That the short-term buck you're trying to make is more important than the long-term concerns of a planet which is choking to death on pollution and all the things that are going to change with the new administration. The saddest and most tragic thing that's going to change is a total disregard for anything approaching prioritizing the planet over money and profit.
That's the sad part. That is really sad. I know. It's a sad part in the environment and climate control and all of that. So, what does the ISIS leader request of the people of the village? And when they tell him no, what does he do? And there are like two more characters. I think I'm going to leave them out because we don't want to give away too much. What happens when they turn him down? Because you don't turn down ISIS. They're crazy. Crazy.
You have raised a fantastic issue. It's a fantastic issue because it goes to the nature of villainy.
Yeah.
Great heroes are made by great villains. If you think about the first Star Wars, which was Episode 4, when they're going to test the Death Star, they don't just do it randomly. They do it on Princess Leia's home planet of Alderaan. They destroy her home planet. You can't redeem yourself from something that horrible. So when you're creating a villain in a modern day thriller where pretty much everything has been done, you look for new ways of creating characters who are despicable in a way that is terrifying. So what I think I did in Strong Cold Dead, just as a little spoiler alert again, there are so many pieces to these books like Strong Cold Dead, I can give a lot of them away and not give anything away. It's one thing to line up a bunch of children, the oldest child of each villager who has betrayed the ISIS terrorist who's come for his revenge, come for what he's that's we've seen that 1,000 times. It's horrible. You massacre him. You know, we've seen ISIS do it, and you know we've seen it. It's real. I want to do something different. So what he basically says is, you will kill your own firstborn child, or I will kill all your children. And the creating a notion of a villain like that, and the Caitlin Strong books are full of people like this. The scariest chapter I ever wrote, Fran, the scariest chapter in all my career of writing, is chapter 41 of Strong Vengeance, the fourth book in the Caitlin Strong series. I'm not going to give anything away, but I will tell you that nothing happens in the scene. There's no violence. Any more than if you're a fan of No Country for Old Men, the book and the movie, the scariest scene in a movie that's full of them, to me, was when the killer, played brilliantly by Javier Bardem, Anton Chigurh, goes into the gas station just to pay for his gas. And he psychologically tortures the man, the simple man behind the counter. I was shaking watching that scene. And when I wrote chapter 41 of Strong Vengeance, I was looking for that same effect. Creating a villain who is terrifying, despicable, and chilling without doing a single, and that's, now of course later on he's going to, and you're going to find out about stuff he's done. But that's the first time you meet him. So that's what you're getting at with the ISIS commander in this book.
Well, it's too bad that we don't have Caitlin Strong and a few others to go after them in real life. Maybe then we would win a
You know
faster.
Something? But, you know, before we get to the next question, in a sense we do, though. Because how many successful Navy SEAL and Delta Force raids have taken out subs?
They have, and it's amazing.
How many plots have been thwarted? Say what you want about the FBI, and there's a lot of bad, justifiably, you can say about the FBI. But how many plots have they thwarted? So the thing is, we are winning. We are winners. But we don't always – we exaggerate the losses because they're so dramatic. But with the exception of an event like the killing of Osama bin Laden, most of what our modern-day heroes do goes under the radar, because we can't know what it is, or we'll know that they did it, and the bad guys will be ready the next time they come.
Yeah, you don't want them to know.
So I diverted, so we will get back on track now.
Okay, we have a few more questions because we have about 7-8 minutes. I love this statement because you sort of made it just now. Caitlin says so beautifully, nobody wins all of the time, but the thing is, that doesn't stop us from trying.
Oh,
and
my God.
That was just, see, I told you I was going to, I looked things up and I quote very well.
Wow. I think that's the last line of the book, isn't it?
Yeah, that was the last line in the book, and the book is in front of me, so I didn't forget it. I have it in front of
me.
My
God.
You see, when I get a John Land book and it's autographed, I just bury it because I might want to read it again, and no one's getting it. And it's very dangerous in this house because even my super's wife, my exterminator, everyone, and the lady down the hall, you know, says, "What do you have to read?" Because everybody knows I'm a book reviewer. I even walked into Marshall's the other day, and the lady behind the counter said, "What are you bringing us to read?" I go, like, "How did you know?" They treated me like I was a rock star. I said, "Oh my God, this is nice." So, what does that mean?
And as an author, how glad am I that there are people like that that are still talking about books and wanting to read? Because the fact is, print sales are up 20%. So we're doing okay.
Well, that's even better. That's it. And if everybody would buy for the holiday every one of John's books, and you definitely make a lot of people very happy, because my sister-in-law, my brother-in-law, everyone in my family, I can't go anywhere. Even to the hairdresser, this lady said to me yesterday, "Could you bring something and leave it for me?" I'm like, I didn't even know who the lady was, but somebody told her that I write.
Unbelievable.
Said, okay, for you, I'll bring. I was like, this is fantastic. But what does she mean by that? That is the perfect saying at the end of the book. Nobody wins all of the time, but the thing is, that doesn't stop us from trying. That's so perfect. In life and in kids trying and just in school and everything. How do you want to relate that to, I mean, for her, she's not going to ever
give
up.
It is the light shining through the darkness. It is the optimism against the gunfire that, you know, that it's not, it goes back to the great line by Vince Lombardi, the greatest achievement is not in rising, but in rising again after you've fallen. The idea that you can't win all the time, but it doesn't stop you from trying means don't quit. Stick to your, it's almost like Caitlin is talking to me about my dream and talking to everyone about pursuing your dream. Her dream was to become a female, one of the first woman Texas Ranger. And she wants everyone in that audience, because what it is a commencement speech that she's giving in the epilogue. She wants everyone in that audience to know that they can be anything they want, that they can do anything they want. Because ultimately, I feel that fiction, pop culture, reading entertainment, like what I write, is far more entertaining and enjoyable when it's positive. There's so much negative in this world. Turn on the news, try to watch it for 20 minutes. You know, especially lately, you can't do it anymore. I mean, it's so hard to walk away from watching the news or watching a news program and not get anxious and not get frustrated. But that's why so the thing is, it's about optimism. It's about positivity. It's about the fact that you can read a Caitlin Strong book and be swept into a world where the good guys win and the right thing happens and people grow up and people learn. So is there a message there? Probably, but I don't think anyone reads my books for the messages. And I don't think consciously, unlike, you know, in your case, because you read everything, I don't think they necessarily know they've been given a message. But subconsciously, I think what keeps people coming back over and over and over again, you know, to the books and continuing to buy each one of the series is this notion that subconsciously all the things I'm trying to do are resonating with them on a level at the gut imaginative level. Where everything is based on instinct, where it's that we write to the child in all of us. We write from the child inside us to the child inside the reader. It's not the adult that we're entertaining. It's the part of the person who never grows up, the part of the person who remembers what it's like to have a parent or grandparent tell them a story before they went to bed. That's what great writing / storytelling is. It creates that same moment. And that same moment needs a positive message.
That is so true, because there's so many negative messages out there. So here's a good question for the end. What is next for Caitlin? This is a good one. This is a 9-part question. What is next for Caitlin? What about Luke and Dylan? They're my favorite. I love these two. And would you ever bring in the storyline about their mother? And is Caitlin ever going to say yes to court to settle down? Never.
Oh God.
What
was the first part of the question?
What is next for Caitlin? What trouble is she going to get
into? Let's talk about that.
For those of you that ever never got skunked, which I did, you don't want to know. It's horrible.
Oh no.
I
am so excited about Strong to the Bone, because I didn't start with the light bulb. I didn't start with the New York Times article or the Time Magazine article or the piece on 60 Minutes. I started with this. You know, we live in an era where so many women are coming forward to say they were sexually assaulted years before. And they were ashamed and they were embarrassed and they didn't tell anybody, and or the attacker was never found. Very early in Strong to the Bone, we learn and we see that Caitlin Strong was sexually assaulted when she was in college.
Oh, wow.
And dealing with that emotionally and coming to and having an opportunity to finally confront the person who did it forms the emotional core of Strong to the Bone. And the thing I absolutely love about this book is things are happening because of characters' weaknesses and flaws. So much goes bad. You know why? You asked about Dylan. Dylan is taking time off from college. He's working at a body shop. And the illegal aliens, this is in San Antonio. So the illegals who work there are being terrorized by this neo-Nazi gang. and Dylan stands up for them. And of course, that sets things in motion. Once the fuse is burning, you can't put out the flame. And he's doing bad things happening because characters are doing the right thing. That is the essence of complexity and ambiguity. Never said that before. Never said that before in all the years I've been interviewed. But that's the definition of what makes a book something special, what takes it to another level. Bad things happening out of good intentions, out of someone trying to do good and something bad results. And that's Strong to the Bone, which will be coming at this time next year.
Well, I can't wait to get it. So here's another question that will stump the world. What would you do? Could you ever bring back my other favorite character, Blake McCracken, and make him work with Caitlin Strong together? Because he's just as dynamite, but he's much older.
Well, you know, it's difficult I've thought about doing stuff like that in the past, but what happens is the concept overwhelms, the doing that overwhelms the story because there's not enough screen time for all these people. I did toy with the fact that in an early scene in Pandora's Temple where I bring McCracken back, he rescues a bunch of kids who were kidnapped by the drug cartel in Mexico. And he gets across the Texas border and a woman Border Patrol agent comes forward and basically, you know, she fires her gun and scares off the people who are coming across with guns. I almost made that Caitlin Strong. But I thought it was pushing the envelope a little bit. I thought it was too kind of cute by a half. And, I think that these people are such strong personalities and they live within the worlds that I've created for them, with the universes I've created for them. They don't breathe the same air. So putting them in the same book means that, it doesn't seem to work. It doesn't seem to fit. I would not rule it out for the future, but it just doesn't excite me.
Okay, now my final question is, will Court and Caitlin ever take the next step, and where can we learn more about you and your work?
You can go to johnlandbooks.com, johnlandbooks.com. That has updates. I do a lot of blogs that appear, so if you Google my name, you'll find all kinds of things, and you'll see interviews and stuff like that. But here's the thing about Court Wesley and Caitlin. They are at their closest when they are in the most danger. Their relationship is defined on these moments in which they become who they really are. What your question suggests is that they would try to become something different, and that would make them happy. It would not. They would not be happy being traditional, because that's not the way they think. One thing all great heroes through mythic lore, and this comes from Joseph Campbell. This is not John Land. This is Joseph Campbell, The Power of Myth. All heroes pay a price for their heroism. They are doomed to live alone. They are isolated. They live apart from humanity because their duty does not allow them to reside among us. That has not changed since the time of Ulysses. All Odysseus wants to do in the Iliad and the Odyssey is get home. That's all he wants, and he can't do it. He can't do it. It's the simplest quest of all, a man trying to get home. He's being denied what should be a right, because it's not the nature of a hero to be able to go home. It's what Thomas Wolfe said when he wrote You Can't Go Home Again. Well, a hero, a traditional American hero. Now, that's what I'm writing. I'm writing the frontier, rugged Western individualist. There are plenty of thriller heroes where the payoff is they get to have a normal life. They get to have their cake and eat it too. As do Caitlin and Court Wesley. It's just that they bake the cake differently. They get it, but it's not the same cake as you and I would eat, because they're not the same people. They don't define themselves the way you and I define themselves. So to say, when are they going to get together? When are they going to get to be happy? Is to ascribe on them values that they don't possess, that aren't, that we have, that are important to us, but might not be important to them. We're talking about them like they're real people. And you know what? To me, they are.
Yeah, well, to all of us, they are. But I want to thank you so very much. And I've done something I never do. I went over the hour. Yeah, that's okay. And I'm going to be doing the panel show, like I said, on January 16th. And in February, I think I have a tentative date for the 16th of February. And I think we're going to talk about we're doing voice and point of view on January 30th. And I'm going to I think I may do a show on mood and tone in a story. And yeah, different, right?
Very task specific for very esoteric for writers when you get into mood and tone as opposed to character and plot. You know, it's not something we consciously think of. It's something that has to be there in the subtext. It has to be there. It has to be a part of the fabric of what we're creating. It would be a very interesting discussion. You got me started now, so I'm going to stop.
Oh, good, because I'm going to ask you to be on that show. Ha ha.
Oh, God. Count me in.
I'm going to count you in, that definitely, and I have to see who else I would like to count in. For those of you that don't know, Steve Berry came out with The Lost Order, and guess who's reading it? My husband, he took it out of my hand. He won't let me read it first. And I'm interviewing him April 24th. Yeah,
oh,
you read it?
Treat. I'm reading it right now. It's one of his best books yet. And he's the master of what he does. The historical, speculative thriller. He's brilliant.
And one of these days, I've got to get you and Steve Berry and Alan Topol and Alan Jacobson on the same show so we could talk about that.
Maybe you need David Morrell on that. You need the professor. You need the David is the creator of Rambo. David is our we call him professor. He was a professor for real, but we also call him that because he is the guy we emulate more than anyone else. He invented what we do and has more theories on writing and on thriller. So you put me and Steve and David in a room and just let us go and 26 hours later come in and we're still talking.
Well, I'm going to email David Morrell on my own because I'm reading his book. So as soon as I'm done with his book, I'm going to ask him if he would ever do a panel show whenever he wants to do it. And then I'll count you in on that one. And maybe we can get Steve to do it also. That would really be interesting, probably get 1,000 listeners too. So everyone, I am so excited. It's going to rain. No, the sun is almost out. the sun is almost, We had snow. And you must have had snow, too, and I hate snow. And we still have a little bit of snow. And before I forget, happy birthday, Jake, and you're going to be 13 tomorrow. And your aunt is so proud of you because you're a straight-A student like I was, and I'm so excited. And I hope everybody has a great day. And, John, I will keep you posted on February 16th on Mood and Tone, and I'm going to see who I'm going to ask. And if you have any people that you would like me to ask, just let me know. And everyone, have a great day. John, have a great day. Thank you so much for today. This has been my best interview yet for the year.
Oh,
and don't
my
forget
God.
To buy.
I had a blast. It seems like it was 5 minutes long.
It was more than that. That's okay.
I know.
We went over by 10 or 15, but that's okay because I have the show on for 2 hours. That's why I always overdo it. So everybody,
there
have a great day. And go out and go on Amazon and buy all of John's books. You won't be sorry. Have a nice day and bye.
Bye, Fran. Thank you.